Welcome to NucleCast, the official podcast of the Amlod Deterrence Center. Our host is Dr. Adam Lauffel, co-founder and vice president for research at the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. The Amlod Deterrence Center is a 501c3 organization ensuring a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrence and its ongoing modernization. Thank you for listening and welcome to the show. The views of the host and the guests are their own.
Welcome back to another great episode of NucleCast. Of course, I am your host, as always, Adam Lauffel. And today, we have a great guest. I'm talking about Colonel, retired Curtis McGiffin, the Vice President of Education at the National Institute for Deterrence Studies and visiting professor at Missouri State University. Curtis, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me again, Adam. I think this is my third time on NucleCast.
Well, you know, the only way for that to happen is for you to have something interesting to say. So.
Well, then I'm not sure this is another exciting episode.
So the reason I wanted to talk with you is because you and I wrote an article recently, about a week or two weeks ago, in which we explained in more detail why we think America needs an AI-enabled NC3 system with a dead hand. And it was, you know, the third in a series of articles we had written about this. We initially wrote back in 2019, and we received, you know, significant criticism and that, you know, we'll never do that. That'll never happen. But we do know that AI is being incorporated into various systems, and you know, it's for many people, they see it as they instantly go to Hollywood because apparently all truth comes from Hollywood. It's made in a movie. But you and I would disagree.
Or the internet.
Adam. Yeah. Social media is another great place.
That's
to get
another
the truth.
One. Absolutely.
So, but, you know, we disagreed that any use of an artificial intelligence tool necessarily leads to Skynet or the Whopper or anything like that. But we thought that there were significant problems with our NC3 system and then the presidential decision-making process. So walk us through what you think are the reasons why we need an AI-enabled NC3 system to begin with.
All right. Well, it's a big question, Adam. So let me see if I can sort of get this delivered shortly in a short amount of time. When we first wrote our article, America Needs a Dead Hand, which is, you can find it on waronthrocks.com, back in 2019, so 5 years ago, we were just beginning, I think, as a nation to really embark on this modernization of the nuclear command, control, and communication system as part of the greater nuclear enterprise that the whole country is going through. And the modernization of the systems, you know, are expensive, and we're going through all that, and they're all things that need to be done. And in an effort to make it more resilient and to operate maybe a little bit faster, of course, you know, we'll introduce new vulnerabilities and have to overcome those things. All of that is, you know, sort of in construction phase. But what we don't do is really tackle what I think, or what I think we think is the long pole in the NC3 tent, which is the decision maker, the senior decision maker. We're not modernizing that person, no pun intended, right? In that they don't, there's nothing done. There's nothing being done to make their decision to do the hardest thing on the worst of days under the most incredible of environments a little bit easier. And so as you and I have evolved, and as the geopolitical environment has evolved over the last 5 years, we now see things with a lot more clarity. Some of the things that we wrote about in 2019 are coming to fruition in 2024 and beyond. And I think so now we wrote this America Needs a Dead Hand now more than ever, or more now than more than ever, right? You and I debated the titles. You won, I didn't. And essentially, what we sort of argued is sort of the next step is that here's how we think it can be done. And we try to overcome the proverbial question or complaint that we're trying to hand over America's nuclear codes and launch authorities to an AI creature. And that simply is not the case. And those who think that that's what we advocate for, I would argue, are not reading the article properly. And that I think we do a pretty good job of really laying out how the president and the secession of the president that makes this launch order happen, how they can actually prepare and make some of these decisions in a much calmer time and be able to sort of be preloaded, which would then the AI can offer, accepting all of this information coming in through the dual phenomenology of our surveillance and identification capabilities, and then sort of saying, Mr. President, here's what we think about is going on in a nanosecond, and say, this matches a criteria that we've already thought about and talked about. And on this date 2 years ago, in the calmness of the White House Oval Office over a cup of coffee, you decided you would do X. Do you still want to do X? And then the president would have an option. Yes, I want to do X. No, I don't want to do X. Or no, I don't want to do X. Give me another option. And then the AI could say, well, here are the three options closest to this situation. In a maybe a max, medium, and min. And you do you want to do one of these three? And then the president can make a decision. And I think it's pretty you still have the human in the loop, right? So I think it's pretty cogent methodology of decision support done in a critical circumstance and easing through all of this. And later on in the conversation, Adam, I want to talk about why this is important to deterrence.
So let me just help create a sort of a clearer mental image for some of the listeners. So
I wasn't clear enough.
So, I mean, you've talked about it so much that, you know it inside and out.
That's right.
But for those who haven't really heard the argument before, I want to sort of take it down to a more fundamental level, in the sense that our initial argument in 2019 was that we have an attack time compression problem.
That's right.
The speed at which a president has to make a decision is faster because of low observable cruise missiles, because of hypersonics, because of new capabilities the Russians and the Chinese and potentially the North Koreans are making. And this is consistent with the history of NC3. Bombers took hours, ICBMs came along, then it was compressed to 30 minutes. And then when SLBMs came in, it was compressed to 15. And now we're down to 6 to 10, maybe. Right. Or we may not even know until a strike happens. And that's what we call attack time compression. And those are things that are happening. And we have an NC3 system that was built for a previous era. And our logic was, you can use artificial intelligence tools, right? So a NC3 system is 160 plus separate systems that are tied together to analyze information and pass that information forward. And so what our premise was, those individual systems perform discrete functions. So for example, you have space-based infrared that satellites that detect a launch of an ICBM because they're pointed in the direction where those ICBMs are, and they look for the heat signature, the IR signature. And then they send that back down to the Missile Warning Center. The Missile Warning Center looks at it and determines what is it. And then it looks at, looks at tracks and it makes analyses and then passes that on. And so there's all these discrete functions that are happening. And so our premise was that you can have AI tools not an AI, not a general AI, mm-hmm. but specific tools, whether you're using random forest, you know, so these are all algorithms, mathematical algorithms, and you're going to have those algorithms do one discrete function, you know, determine whether something is an IR signature or not. And you can have multiple AI. This is one of the important things people to understand is you're not going to have one AI do something and that's that. You'll have multiple algorithms of different designs look at the same thing to try to determine whether they reach the same conclusion. And if they do, then the information is passed forward. And this approach is faster than the current approach. Now, you'll have a mix of hard coding, you'll have different types of algorithms, and you'll have, they'll be throughout the whole system. And then we ultimately get to what you were talking about in terms of all this information has come into the president and the president's making a decision. So create a mental image for the listeners about this process that you briefly described of when the president is elected and he takes office early in his presidency, what happens then? So what is step one?
So fantastic description of all of the magic, right, that happens in the electronic world and all of that. And so then what I think we argue here is this is an opportunity. A president is newly elected within the first few weeks of inauguration. This president sits down for a day or two and reviews all of the potential attack scenarios that could occur, from little one-off decapitation attacks all the way to a massive laydown from either adversary.
And so bring in the Secretary of Defense.
Yeah, you got to bring in all. You're getting the intel briefings. You're getting an understanding of what's going on in the geopolitical world. You get an understanding of what the adversaries have and do and are thinking about and might be willing to do and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It would be a sobering event, I'm sure, for those 48 hours. And you get all of these scenarios that our strategists and planners have concocted over the last 30, 40 years. I mean, they understand this. And then you're presented these options. Maybe they're most likely to least likely or these sorts of things. And as the president, over a cup of coffee, when knowing you've had the intel brief, you've got advisors sitting next to you, and you say, okay, if this happens, Mr. President, what would you do? What would you want to do? What would you want your advisors to tell you to do under this circumstance? And then in the cool, calm, and collective event, they could say, okay, if this specific scenario is occurring, I would choose option X. Okay. And then they log that down. And they'll go through maybe another 50 to 100 potential scenarios. And you go down, and the president can pick all of those different options and have them pre-decided in it, without the fog and friction of war going on, without all of the other things worrying about, you know, their family and getting from place to place as they're being hustled about and in survival mode, if you will. And more importantly, Adam, is it gives the president a real opportunity to really assess in a sobering manner what all of this means, right? What are the ramifications of this? I need to understand what is my role as the commander in chief, and as the, if you will, you know, in my constitutional role to protect the United States. And so I think this really can speed up that decision-making process, and it changes it from a conversation in the midst of battle about here's what's going on, sir. What would you like to do, ma'am? To here's the situation. You've already decided you want to do this. Confirm you still want to do that. Human is still in the loop, Adam. Human is still in the loop, and nothing is being happened without the authority of the president saying yay or nay, but it's a lot faster now. And all of that theater that goes on in that critical time of in the midst of a nuclear attack, that almost can be done away with, or at least shortened in a tremendous amount of time.
Now, one of the important things I think for our listeners probably know this because most of our listeners, you know, work in the nuclear enterprise. But for those that may not and are sort of interested Americans and folks from other countries, perhaps, our president, unlike Vladimir Putin, Xi Jinping, does not participate in nuclear war games, exercises, anything of that sort. And so when the president, let's suppose that worst day happens, is tasked, you know, he's a presidential decision conference is called and he's given, Mr. President, here's what's inbound. We've got to make a decision. That's almost like, you know, certain that that'll be the first time he's thought about this issue. And I don't know about you, but in the Navy, we had something called OJT, on-the-job training. That is the worst type of on-the-job training I've ever heard of. And so part of our objective was that a president will have the opportunity to sit down when there's no stress or strain, just like you said, and think through these things. And then you program his decisions into the system such that in a matter of seconds, when the system detects, you know, what's inbound, there's seven ICBMs from North Korea inbound, that the system will say, okay, Mr. President, you had a scenario that was almost like this, and here's what you said you would do in that scenario. And so it in that time of stress and strain, like you said, when he's trying to get to Air Force One, trying to get into the bunker, whatever, and he's still being told you have to make a decision or you need to, he doesn't have to. Let's dispel one of Andy Jacobson's myths. The president doesn't have to do anything. And, you know, the STRATCOM commander, the SecDef, they all work for him. He doesn't work for them. They don't force him to do anything. And so her assertion that, you know, the president's forced into things is just absolutely false. But if he does choose, he's likely choosing, and the bigger the strike package that's coming our way, probably the more likely a decision will be made quickly. If it's, a couple, like in her original scenario, two North Korean, he's not going to make a quick decision. So we want to give that president who is facing stress and strain, we want to feed back, hey, here's what you thought about this a scenario almost like this during, you know, a peaceful time. And we think that's a boon to the president in terms of information. So if he is, let's suppose like Annie Jacobson, who claims the military pressures him and is aggressive, he can say, whoa, 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 guys, I thought about this in a peaceful time. And here's what I decided in a peaceful time. So, you know, I won't be pressured into doing something I don't want to do. That's part of what we're, you know, what we're seeking to achieve with this, which is, I think perfectly reasonable. I don't know about you, Curtis, but.
Well, sure. I mean, we're advocating for it. I think there's another benefit to this as well. And that is that, the value of this to the presidential successor, right? So you're the department of, you're the Secretary of Labor, and now all of a sudden you're the sole surviving.
Yeah. Yeah. You're ninth in line.
Right. And congratulations. You're now Mr. President. Here's a list of options that the elected president already made a decision to do. Do you want to do these? And so again, you don't have to go through more OJT. These decisions have already been made. You're simply selecting the option of whatever it is you want to do, and then go through it. And then the AI can assist with the transmitting of the orders and those sorts of things. But that's the system working. It's just transmitting and getting the order out to the forces to decide what it is they're going to execute whatever the decision was, whatever the decision option that the president decided to do and selected at the time. And that can increase also the potential of the successful transmission as well. I think AI can assist with that.
All right. Well, it's that time of the show where we have to take a quick break. So we'll be right back.
This episode of NucleCast is brought to you by the AMLA Deterrent Center. whose mission is to educate Americans about the nuclear enterprise and strategic deterrence.
And we're back, and we're talking to Colonel retired Curtis McGiffin, and we are talking about using AI tools within an NC3 system. So it's not an AI system. It's discrete tools that perform discrete functions within a much larger system of systems. So you might have hundreds of discrete algorithms doing very narrow things. And that's an important thing to keep in mind. It's there's no general artificial intelligence here. Now, one of the options that we do talk about is, thus far we've been discussing sort of the system when it's in manual, but we also propose an automatic option to the system in which the president, let's suppose the president says, hey, put it on auto, which he can use as a signal to the adversary, by the way. And then he can tell the system, hey, if you detect, you know, scenario 47, then execute, you know, my chosen selected response to option 47. And you can tell the system to do these things. So it's not the system making decisions for you. It's the system executing pre-selected decisions the president makes. And so it's not quite, you know, it's not Skynet by any stretch, but it is something, you know, that's essentially a smart perimeter system, which the Russians have themselves. And so the question is this a good idea or a bad idea? For many Americans, they just, the idea that we would have our own essentially dead hand, which is what it is, right? So the president gets killed and then the system, you know, operates automatically as per, you know, perimeter loses communications with the Russian command authority. And if it loses communications, then it launches. So, you know, we're offering somewhat of a similar option. Can you address the strengths and weaknesses of such a system?
So, yeah, and I think that is how it pertains to the success of deterrence, right? So we know that the Russian perimeter system was developed in the late 80s. Early 80s, but it was actually really deployed in the late 80s. And then it was sort of fine-tuned in the 90s when peace was breaking out all over the world. And the issue here is there's many who believe, of which I'm one of them, but there's probably other reasons as well, that perimeter was sort of a reaction to decisions made in the Carter era under PD-59 and going into the Reagan era about the actual targeting of senior leaders in the Soviet Union. As being the thing that they most value the most is themselves, right? And so you hold at risk them. And so their way of deterring the attack on them is to create this automated system that even if you get us, we're going to get you back. And this creates a deterrent effect that makes us take pause and maybe think twice about going first. And this whole idea about deterrence. And we've sort of tolerated this, right? Because we don't, you know, our version of the dead hand was the looking glass. We had looking glass flying 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for 365 days a year for 30 some odd years during the Cold War. There was an airplane and a crew and a general officer all prepared to basically lead the nuclear attack and retaliation should everything else on the ground be destroyed. That still sort of serves today, but it's different, right? It's much more proactive. And in the sense you've got an airplane going on, all this, a lot more expensive, I assume, and so forth. Now, you know, again, we've tolerated this sort of, for those out there who think that what we're talking about is destabilizing, we've tolerated this destabilizing behavior from the Soviets, now Russians, four decades, and we seem to feel like it's okay. But all of a sudden, if we think we need to do it, all of a sudden that's a problem. And so that's
I never hear anybody, you know, saying I lie awake at night worrying about the Russian perimeter system.
Exactly.
Nobody says that.
Yeah. It's probably out of, you know, just a lack of knowledge. If you really understood it, you might lie awake. but the point here is that, you know, it is about what you do to create this effect on deterrence. And so the negative part of this, of course, is you've got to overcome the preconceived notions of the evil of AI and or the, you know, mixing it with the most powerful weapons of America's arsenal and all of the sort of political ramifications that go with it. Putting that aside, we look at the effect of deterrence, and if the adversary, whoever they may be, the nuclear armed adversary, believes that there is nothing they can do to prevent the retaliation order by the senior leaders going out to the forces and then the actual retaliation happening. In other words, there's no way that you're not going to get struck back in an intolerable manner. Then that creates pause, right? Caution breeds hesitation. Hesitation breeds inaction. Inaction brings peace. And so the idea here is that if we can do things that create a sense of pause on the side of the adversary, I argue we are increasing stability, that we are increasing the opportunity for peace, and I would say at very little cost.
Yeah, it's I agree with you, but you know, one of the things we've seen is we've seen people say, "Hey, well, no president would ever sit down and essentially show his cards in terms of I'm going to do something. I'm going to, you know, here's the decision I want." And, you know, I think they're probably right in terms of it's not something presidents have done because presidents don't think about nuclear use options. But for this, the geostrategic environment we're moving into, in which our three main adversaries are going to have a nuclear arsenal that's two or three times larger than ours. And I think Matt Kronig has done a fairly good job of showing that nuclear dominance leads the weaker power to back down in, you know, from coercion frequently. I just am concerned that if we continue to have presidents who never think about it, that puts us at a distinct disadvantage. And it puts us at an instance in which the Russians and the Chinese feel more enabled to use 1, 2, 5, 10 nuclear weapons and believe that we will not respond. And so a president making good decisions early in the process, I think, has a deterrent effect.
Well, I agree with you, and I want to clarify one of your statement here just a minute or two ago is that presidents don't normally think about this. And to clarify that was saying American presidents don't normally think about this. I would assume President Putin and President Xi and certainly Kim Jong-un, whatever you want to call him, they think about this often and have gone through the motions. I would argue that Putin in his 24 years of leadership with six more to go has rehearsed making a nuclear decision upon the United States on a number of occasions, is quite comfortable with the decision-making process. And quite frankly, that should be scary. I mean, every time you make the decision in practice, you become just a little bit more numb to it, I suppose. But therein lies the deterrent effect. Right. If it increases our pause, then his deterrent effort is successful. And so we have to figure out ways to smartly deal with this problem because we have plenty of people advocating. We have people out there advocating now that so that we don't build more nuclear weapons, Adam, it is time to go back to a counter value targeting scheme. And that we should target the cities of and innocent people of Russia and China in order to hold them at risk And this is what our adversaries do to us, but we've not been in the business of doing that. It violates our morals and ethics and our law of armed conflict and these sorts of things. But we actually have people here in the United States now that are beginning to advocate to that because they're concerned that we're going to build more nuclear weapons to continue a counter-force strategy. Adam, it's a whole nother conversation. We should probably have it another nuclecast topic at some point in the future. But my point here is that if you're concerned about America adding to capacity, then you should be open to almost any and every great idea that could possibly multiply your effect without multiplying your forces. And I'm arguing that this is a applicable technology that can multiply the effect of our deterrence forces without actually multiplying our numbers of deterrence forces.
Now, before we run out of time, I want to bring out Bob the Genie. So as I rub my magic lamp and Bob, of course, grants you three wishes related to the topics we've been discussing. Curtis, let me ask you, what is wish number one?
All right. So wish number one, I really wish that we would really pay heed to the Commission on the Strategic Posture, which I think was a brilliant piece of bipartisan work. I think it's time that we now start thinking about nuclear weapons on mobile platforms to make them more survivable. We need to consider full spectrum capability, including low yield, smaller weapons. I believe that if our adversary has a weapon of this capability, we should have it too. That should be the parity measurement. So if my first wish would be is we got to get past whatever it is that's slowing us down here in doing the right thing and start doing that.
Okay. So that's a good wish. How about wish number two?
So wish number two is, and it may sound a little bit like number one, but I really wish we would see the Air Force specifically, and the Navy too. We do need more capacity in the survivable platforms, more bombers, probably more submarines, and we need to place the bombers back on alert in order, again, to make them more survivable and to begin to, if you will, let's add more value, deterrent value to the forces that we have until we can garner more forces should that be needed. I think it's time that the Air Force get back in the business of performing these kinds of nuclear deterrent capabilities and start bringing back that culture in order to deter a first strike.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about it, you really only have to take out a couple of weapon storage areas with conventional munitions, by the way. You could, and the bomber force is useless. So putting them back on alert, I think, is probably a good idea. Okay, so good wish. How about wish number three?
Third wish. Well, I'd wish for three more wishes. I think we're making great headway in the education side of things. What I think we're still fighting is I wish that our political parties could come back together on this question of nuclear deterrence. During the Cold War, you often couldn't tell a Republican from a Democrat when it came to nuclear. In fact, some of the biggest nuclear deterrent hawks were Democrats. And again, I'm not trying to pick on one political party over another, even though I'm saying Democrats or Republicans. Some of them are pro and con as well. My point is I would love to see or would wish to have our political parties come together on this, because I believe that it is in the nation's best interest to have a robust, fully capable, and potent, credible, fearful nuclear a deterrent in order to prevent war. I think we concentrate way too much on having weapons of war so we can actually use them. And I would like us to spend more time and money on creating the weapons of peace that allow us to be a little nervous about waging wars, and maybe we'll figure out other ways to solve our disputes differently. So, and I think part of that comes to this political fight that we see between the two parties. So I'd like my wish would be is to see the two parties come together on this so that we could be able to move forward on that. Let's argue about other things. This probably ought not to be one of them.
All right. Curtis McGiffin, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Adam.
Yeah, it's good to have you back. Good to talk about a topic we both care about. So NC3 and, you know, dead hands and things of that nature. So it's a good discussion. And of course, thanks to you, the listeners, for joining us on this episode of NucleCast. Well, it's always great to talk to Curtis. You know, the idea of a dead hand and an AI-enabled NC3 system is something that most people sort of flinch at the notion, but hopefully this discussion was informative, and maybe you walk away thinking, well, I can understand that. It's, you know, it's not quite what I thought. This might be doable. So hopefully you enjoyed the discussion.
This has been a production of the Anwar Deterrence Center, a 501c3 that seeks to educate key decision makers, stakeholders, and the public to ensure a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrence. Our executive producer is Kimberly Charrington, and this episode has been engineered and mixed by David Grunthal. Help us grow our followers by sharing it and follow the show on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter at NucleCast.